saying, "Careful, careful," about 30 times in a row, while I worked the scoop into the opening. I finally had it all the way in and started to withdraw the scoop.
"She's not coming out," Natasha said.
"She's stuck."
"Well, pull on her feet, for God's sake."
A few moments later, Anne came loose. She gushed out with the scoop. There was a lot of fluid and other stuff. I didn't even want to look.
"Oh, my God," Natasha said. "She's got an umbilical cord."
I felt my stomach heave a little, but I tried to keep it together.
"So far, so good," I said.
"First, let's check her vitals."
"Heart beating, but I don't think she's breathing. What are we going to do, James?"
Hold on. I wrestled Anne's flopping nude body onto a gurney. The umbilical cord was pulsing, still beating with purplish blood. I had to wonder what was at the other end of that hose-thick blood vessel. Did the machine have a heart of its own beating somewhere inside? I tried not to think about that. I tried not to think about anything at all. I tilted Anne's head to one side and fished in her mouth.
"There's like a plug in here, something rubbery. Rip it out."
I did it. I'm not sure I've ever had to do anything worse, but I did it. A lot of liquid flowed out, but I didn't see any blood. Natasha pushed her fingers on Anne's chest. Anne's small, perfect breasts shivered.
"I think she's dead," Natasha said.
She bent forward and gave her mouth to mouth.
"Keep trying. I'll try to figure out how to work the defibrillator."
Fortunately, I never had to shock Anne with the defibrillator. I'm sure that if I had, I'd have jolted myself to death somehow.
"She's breathing now," Natasha said. "We've got a pulse and a breath. I think we did it."
"I don't know," I said. "She looks a little green."
"That's just the afterbirth."
"Maybe." Anne started to cough then. She wheezed, spasmed, and shifted into a fetal ball. I felt for her. She'd been revived by two amateurs and spit out of a broken machine. If there was any possible way we could have screwed this up, we'd probably done it. Natasha and I looked on helplessly while Anne's eyes fluttered open. She coughed with a deep, lung-ripping sound.
"Anne?"
Natasha said gently, running her fingers over Anne's face to push back the lank, wet hair that was plastered to her forehead.
"What the fuck are you two doing in here?"
Anne gasped, then went into a fresh round of wet coughing. Natasha and I grinned in relief. Her heart was beating, her lungs were working, and she could talk. We felt like proud parents at that moment. A few seconds later, we weren't so happy. Anne slipped off the gurney head first. She'd passed out. We lifted her limp form as gently as we could and put her back onto the table. We tried to awaken her again.
"Anne,"
Natasha kept saying,
"you have to tell us what to do. What's wrong, Anne?"
Anne's mouth worked, but she didn't say anything intelligible. Natasha bent close to listen.
"She's talking about the cord," she said.
I looked and immediately noticed that the umbilical cord had grown dark and was no longer pulsing.
"I bet it's killing her," I said. "We have to cut it. Get the flesh printer."
I reached for my father's knife and drew the blade, quickly wiping it on my suit. I didn't have time to sterilize it or even to think about what I was doing.
"She's going, James," Natasha said urgently. "Do it."
I began to saw at the cord. It was slippery and tougher than it looked, but the blade was insanely sharp. A surgeon's scalpel couldn't have done a better job. A moment later, Anne looked like she had a pumpkin stem sticking out of her belly. Just as with a newborn baby, the cord had a valve in it that prevented heavy bleeding. We pinched it closed anyway and sprayed fresh cells over it like there was no tomorrow. After another minute or so, Anne was conscious again. She wasn't happy, however.
"You two shouldn't be here. Where are my people?"
"They're dead," I told her. "All of them. The Tribune ordered us to revive you. We're supposed to get you started on reviving the rest of our troops." Anne looked around in confusion until she saw the bodies that still littered the deck.
"The colonists," she said,
then turned an accusing eye toward me.
"You said they were harmless peasants hiding under rocks. They came in here like a pack of wolves. They tore us apart.
I never said they were harmless, I said. And they don't have much in the way of tech, just nanite blades and tools.
That was plenty. They came at us so suddenly. The drones and trip lines on the perimeter around the lifter didn't work. There was no warning. You techs failed us, too.
Anne wasn't being reasonable, but I knew how she felt. I often came off the table fuming after a bad death. The fight that ended your life was often still fresh in your mind. One of the odd things about revival technology was the fact you could often remember your own dying moments. Our neural connections were constantly recorded whenever we were in range of the Legion networks. Updating a person's mental state wasn't as data-heavy as it sounded, because the system only recorded changes to your synapses and neural pathways, not your entire mind. Like many large databases, the system saved only the parts of the mind that differed when compared to the latest refresh. Most of the contents of any human brain were fairly static, such as long-term memories and basic skills. Only our most recent memories needed to be stored on a continuous basis. Our bodies were even easier to work with. Once the entire DNA sequence was input, only a few alterations had to be recorded. For example, a person might have had their wisdom teeth removed when they first joined the Legion. It wouldn't be helpful to revive such a person with a fresh toothache that would have to be surgically fixed every time, especially during a campaign. Using DNA blueprints to map out the basic design of the body, then storing changes that resulted naturally from age and artificially from repairs such as surgeries, the machine was able to reproduce a copy without the injuries that killed the person in the first place. This had the side effect of being able to make a person younger after they died and were revived. If there was no good reason to save a person's body, the system didn't bother. The revival units just grew a new body that was often years younger than the original, and put the freshly copied mind into it. Anne finally noticed she was nude and climbed slowly down off the table. We held her up, but she slapped our hands away. Moving painfully, she got a fresh uniform wrapped around herself and let the flaps close and seal over her skin.
"I need a shower," she said. "Why am I so coated in slime? Oh, I get it. You clowns didn't even drain the machine's underbelly before you pulled me out, did you?"
We shook our heads.
"Amateurs. This is embarrassing. I'm probably operating on a bad grow. I think I have a fever. What about—"
Anne broke off and sucked in her teeth in a horrified gasp as she finally took a good look at the revival machine itself.
"What did you do?" she demanded. "Are you idiots or vandals?"
"A little of both, I guess," I admitted. Natasha wisely chose that moment to duck out of the room.
"I'm going to report in," she said as she vanished. "Drusus needs to know we've been successful."
Anne glared after her with baleful eyes. Then she turned her reddened orbs toward me. "The colonists damaged the machine during the battle," I explained. "We came in here and killed them all, if it makes you feel better."
"It does. A little," she said.
She walked to the machine and ran her hands over it, then reached inside and pulled something out. A gush of liquid flowed out of the maw and ran into a drain in the floor. I've never been invited into a hospital maternity ward, and at this point, I hoped I never would be. I had to remind myself that babies were supposed to be small, and this alien machine's efforts were probably more disgusting than a normal birth would be. Still, I wanted to get out of here.
"If you're okay," I said, "I'll be—"
"Forget it,"
Anne snapped.
"We're the same rank, but I'm your senior. I need help. You know that by now. Start recharging the plasma tanks. These are no good anymore. You can't leave the fluids hot and under pressure for hours. They turn septic."
That was how it went for me. I was in for the long haul. I resigned myself to my fate, and together, Anne and I began reviving people. We started with Leeson, as officers usually came first. While I worked, I thought about the power these bio people really had in our Legion. They decided, quite literally, who lived and who died. They could bring back whomever they pleased, in the order they pleased. But the reality of this power was muted by the nature of the work. We weren't playing God in this chamber. We were working our asses off. It was a hot, disgusting, and thankless job. Almost always, the newly reborn people were pissed off, sad, depressed, or just plain stunned to be alive again. I couldn't recall getting a single thank you from any of them. After we'd revived about 30 people, everything changed. The first hint came when the bombardment outside on the cliffs halted. For the past several hours, we'd been listening to the steady snap, whine, boom of continuous pounding fire. But it finally stopped. I looked up, sweating and fingers goopy. Anne didn't seem to have noticed anything. She was pulling on a pair of feet and shouting for me to help. "They stopped," I said. "Don't you ever have your mind on the here and now?" she demanded. "I'm glad you aren't an orderly. I'd write you up as the worst failure." I reached past her, grabbed a foot, and pulled. To my surprise, I recognized the body that flopped out. It was Carlos.
"Ew," I complained.
"He's no worse than any of them," Anne said.
"Yeah. Yeah, he is. He's a lot hairier than the average, for one thing."
"Just get him onto the damn table."
I did as she asked. She frowned at Carlos, looking into his eyes and ears, and checking out his vitals with various instruments. My attention wandered.
"I'm going to have to go up and check this out," I said.
"Stand your post, McGill,"
Anne ordered in a commanding tone. Technically, she outranked me, but I had no formal orders from an officer to keep reviving people with her. My place belonged with the combat arm of the unit if something had gone wrong.
"Sorry," I said.
"If you need help, revive a trained orderly next. I'm checking this out." I left her as she fussed over Carlos. She wasn't happy, but she understood. She didn't try to order me to stay again, which was best for both of us. I had to admit to myself, I had mixed reasons for exiting that chamber. I'd had about enough of regrows and recharges, for one thing, but I also had an aching curiosity about the battle outside. Had the colonists waved the white flag? Had Della been killed? When I reached the ramp to the lifter, I was surprised to see it had been lowered. Leeson stood at the head of it, looking down into the bluish light of dawn. I realized with a shock I'd spent half the night in the lifter, working that damned alien machine.
"McGill," Leeson asked, seeing me, "is everyone back on their feet?"
"No, sir. I came out to see what happened. Why did the Primus stop hammering on the cliffs?"
"I don't know," he said, looking worried. "The Tribune called for a ceasefire. There's something going on."
I dared to brighten.
"A ceasefire? Has peace and sanity broken out on this forsaken rock?"
He shook his head. He had the attitude of someone listening. I stopped bugging him, realizing he was connecting on the command channel. As an adjunct, he wasn't really expected to say anything on officer chat, but he was allowed to listen in. Suddenly, he looked at me with wide eyes.
"Get out there," he said. "Take your weapon. Look up and tell me what you see."
I shouldered my belcher and marched out into the cool, dim light of early morning. There was no direct sunlight, but at least the pools of shade all around the valley weren't impenetrable to the eye. Gazing up, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I'd expected something unusual, but not anything this shocking. There was a looming object, lowering itself down silently from the skies. The ship was huge. It wasn't any configuration I'd seen before, either. There was a dish-like silver structure at each end. These rippled with a quiet, powerful amber light of some kind. I didn't know what to make of it. But then I thought maybe I did. I contacted Leeson.
"Sir, there's some kind of big ship out here. It must be a kilometer long. It's coming down right next to the lake between us and the rest of the cohort."
"I'll be damned," Leeson said. Right then, I realized he was still up at the top of the ramp while I was outside. I was exposed to possible incoming fire, but I figured it didn't really matter. If this monster decided to lay a salvo down on top of our lifter, there wasn't much we could do. We'd be obliterated.
What do I do, sir? I asked.
I don't know. No one does. The commanders are all talking about it. We're relaying the imagery to all the lifters.
I used the range finder on my cannon to sight on the ship. It had to be about 5 kilometers off. That was too far for me to damage it from here. Could it be that the Galactic Battle Fleet has arrived? Is this what they look like?
There's a lot of talk about just that possibility. We don't have a record of a ship with this configuration. At least, when we last saw Battlefleet 921, this type of vessel wasn't recorded in orbit over Earth. But that was nearly a century ago. Maybe the Galactics have updated their vessels since the last time they came to this region of the Empire.
Sir, I said, it's down now. I watched as the rippling amber effects around the two dishes stopped strobing. Beneath the ship, countless massive waxy flowers had been crushed. I heard footsteps coming down the ramp behind me. A hand pushed my tube down. I looked at Leeson.
"Were you about to shoot that ship, McGill?" he demanded.
"It had occurred to me," I admitted.
"But it's out of range. Don't shoot anything without orders. If this is a galactic vessel, you might screw up everything. Notice that they haven't fired a shot at us yet. Whoever they are, they look peaceful. We're not to take any chances."
Shrugging, I put the rangefinder back to my eye. "Safety's on," I said. "Just to be sure, though, shouldn't we abandon the lifter?" He shook his head.
"I don't have any orders in that regard."
I looked at him. "The brass is going to be pretty upset if we lose the ship and the revival machine inside."
That got through to Leeson. In Legion Varus, we were all pretty much expendable. Even a permed unit was less important than just one of those precious revival machines. We couldn't replace equipment like that, especially now that Earth was hard up for galactic credits.
"Yeah," he said, nodding half to himself. "We've got to take precautions. Let's get that machine out of there. We'll use the drones to help carry it and stash it among the rocks to the south."
I immediately thought of the colonists who like to haunt the rocks all around their home valley, but I didn't bring it up. Leeson looked worried enough. I knew his orders were to protect the lifter and the revival unit. He didn't want to lose them both at once, no matter what happened. Leeson tramped back up into the dark lifter and disappeared.
"Stand watch out there," he said. "Tell me if anything happens."
I watched the ship, feeling uneasy about it. The design was so alien, so different. I'd made a study of local shipping in the Empire, as had every schoolboy from Earth. This thing didn't look like anything I'd seen before. The ship didn't do anything for several long minutes. Finally, a door opened on the side of the vessel. I stepped from foot to foot in anticipation. What kind of creatures would be manning a real galactic ship? Would the crew consist of the spidery-looking guys I'd met before on Cancri 9? I watched for several long minutes and was disappointed when I saw a delegation of what appeared to be humans walk down the ramp and halt at the bottom. They moved with precision, and it was clear they were soldiers. 9 of them stood in a perfect square in 3 ranks of 3. They wore what looked like armor, but was black and shiny like the carapace of a desert beetle. Straining my eyes and adjusting the scope on my rangefinder, I was able to see them with greater clarity. I had to go up the ramp a ways to get enough height so that my view wasn't inhibited by the towering flower-like growths between them and my position. Then I began to frown. The flowers. Could they be smaller over there next to the ship than they were here at my position? I stared, and my heart began to race. The men who had marched down the ramp and now stood motionlessly at attention were tall. They were about as tall as the flowers themselves.
"Adjunct Leeson," I called. "Something's happened, all right. A squad of men just marched out of that ship."
"Men? Did you say men?"
"Yes, sir. Well, not exactly normal humans. They're about 3 meters tall, all of them. At least, that's what it looks like. It's hard to tell."
Leeson came running down the ramp to stand beside me. He pulled out a scope of his own and stared into it.
"You're right," he said. They're big, and they look human. They can't be, though. If it's a galactic ship, maybe they're using some other race of humanoids from a distant star system for troops, I suggested. Leeson looked baffled. I'm reporting this. Keep watching. I've ordered the techs to send buzzers over there. We'll have more info shortly.
What about the revival machine, sir?
I asked. Here it is now. Several grunting troops in battle armor struggled and heaved a very large object down the ramp. One of them was none other than the freshly reborn Carlos. He looked at me in disgust.
This was your idea, wasn't it?
He asked.
It has to be.
Yeah, pretty much, I admitted.
Where are the pigs? Aren't they supposed to be helping?
Our biggest drones, or pigs, often helped with heavy lifting. Not this time. I guess they're doing something else, I said.
Great. Where are we supposed to drag this monster?
Carlos demanded.
Grant is going crazy. She'll recycle us all next time around just for fun.
I chuckled and shook my head. Carlos and the rest dragged the machine down the ramp and off toward a sheltering circle of boulders. Leeson had to join in to finish the job. The group returned a few minutes later.
We've got it stashed in the safe place for now, Leeson said, coming up to me.
He was breathing hard. Everyone had to strain when carrying the revival unit, even with exoskeletons to help out. It was heavy. I turned back to the strange visiting ship, and as soon as I sighted on the ramp, I knew things were heating up. Previously, there had been a squad of 9 giants standing outside the ship. Now, instead of a single squad, there were at least a dozen squads. Each group stood in a perfect square of 9. Another group marched down in lockstep order as I watched. Their gait was so carefully timed. If I hadn't known better, I would have thought they were robots of some kind.
Sir, I called to Leeson. There are about 100 troops at the base of the ship now.
Leeson came back to my side and stared through his scope.
That's weird.
According to Command Central, these intruders have made no attempt at radio contact. They're not listening to any attempts to hail them either. For perhaps the first time, I felt a little nervous flutter in my guts. Something was wrong. These guys, whoever they were, weren't operating like galactics or humans. Something occurred to me then. What if the giants were human colonists of a different variety? What if the local people that we'd been trying to blast out of these cliffs had more advanced kinsmen? I just didn't understand the situation. The intruders might be on a rescue mission to save the local population from us. Or it might be that Della and her crew were really hunted like rats, and another group of aggressive colonists had come here to wipe them out. I wasn't sure which hypothesis held water, or if any of them did, but I was sure that the situation was a strange one. The procession continued and became even odder as it progressed. The troops stopped marching out of the ship and began unloading equipment instead. Huge boxes, taller than the giants themselves, were carried down and deposited on the ground. When there were about 20 of these lined up outside the ship, I heard a sound I didn't want to hear. A hissing sound passed my faceplate. I saw the bolt flash by me. It struck the support arm of the lifter uncomfortably close to my nose. I reached up and slammed down my visor. Turning in a crouch, I aimed my plasma cannon in the direction I thought the bolt came from. I scanned the foliage, but only briefly. A figure stood at the edge of the forest. She had a slip of white cloth in one hand, which she was waving wildly. In the other hand was a crossbow, which she just used to shoot at me. I knew the woman by this time. It was Della. Chapter 19. Any thinking man would have melted that little witch down without hesitation, but I held my fire. I looked for her friends but saw no one. Of course, that didn't mean they weren't hiding somewhere nearby. I thought about contacting Leeson, but I was worried he'd freak out. I'd taught this girl what the white flag meant, and she'd now decided to use the technique on me.
Would it be right to take revenge now? Heaving a sigh, I decided to take a chance. I knew I'd probably take another trip through the guts of that damned revival machine for my troubles, but for the sake of peace between the colonists and Legion Varus, I lowered my cannon and walked toward her. Della withdrew a few feet into the flowers. I walked up to her and flipped open my visor so she could see my face clearly.
"You are McGill?"
she asked, staring at me warily. "You know who I am," I said. She extended a long, tan arm toward the alien ship.
"Your littermates have come for you. Are you happy?"
"I don't know who those people are," I said, "and I'm definitely not pleased about them crashing this party." She stared at me oddly, turning her head this way and that, as if she was listening to my words and trying to understand if they were true or not.
"How can you not know what they are?"
"You've seen them before? That's what you're saying?" I asked.
"Of course. They're marauders from the stars. They come here on off years when the planets align. They capture as many of us as their ship will hold and fly back into the heavens. We killed some of them, but they always come back, and they always take more than we can kill."
I frowned. "Is that right?" Looking at the ship, I got a creepy vibe from it. "Are you telling me these guys aren't related to you? They aren't your people? They look human enough." She laughed bitterly.
"They are related to us, but in a perverse way. They're bred from our bodies. They're twisted and unnatural, like plants that grow in neat rows under the earth, nourished by lamps rather than sunlight."
I was beginning to catch on. "You told me about this before, right? You said they were littermates. Are there 9 in every litter?" She nodded, staring across the lake.
"For this variety, yes. The armored ones always come in 9s, and they always march with their brothers. There is some humanity still left in them, I think. If you kill one of their brothers, the rest go mad."
"That sounds encouraging. I thank you for the warning. I'll pass the information on to my superiors. Do you think they'll attack us?"
"No," she said. "They never harm anyone unless you harm them first. But they will come, and they will take your weapons from you and destroy them. Then they will place rings around your arms and touch them together like this."
She crossed her wrists to demonstrate.
"Then you will never be able to separate your hands from one another again until they will it. Once bound, you will be herded into the ship and carried away. At first, it's said that many of my people didn't fight. They thought it was better that way. They didn't believe in violence. But all those people are gone from this world by now."
"Only the fighters are left, huh?"
"That's right. For each individual, the choice is clear. Fight and die, or hide and live, maybe. Or submit, and know you will live on in a different place."
"Don't worry. We'll all fight. Every last one of us." Della looked at me suddenly. Her eyes flashed with a fire I'd seen there before. She was a killer, I could see that. A killer through and through.
"Good,"
she said.
"Perhaps there is room for talk between us. You killed my people on this ship, did you not?"
"Yeah," I said. "Sorry about that. They didn't give us any choice." She laughed. That surprised me, as I didn't think anything about the situation was funny.
"You had a choice," she said. "A man always has a choice. You chose to fight rather than to die."
"Well, yeah, I guess so."
"Never apologize for struggling with an enemy who attacks you," she said,
almost as if she was quoting a proverb.
"That is the path to slavery."
"Okay," I said. "How about we make a deal? You don't attack us, and we won't attack you. Not as long as this ship is here. We'll all fight these invaders instead."
Why should I choose one intruder over another? They only want to enslave us. You are trying to kill us.
She had me there. I thought hard for a second. Would they offer you a deal to kick us off the planet? I asked her.
No, she said, shaking her head. They never offer deals. You obey them, or you die. There's no room for anything else in their minds.
Okay, then, I said. Call a truce with us to improve your situation. It's easier to fight one enemy at a time than two at once. Accept my deal, so that we both have a better chance of winning in the end. We'll kill them first, then decide what to do about each other afterward. The odds of victory will improve for both of us.
I will not stand at your side. I do not trust you. Your bombs, to us, you're worse than the littermates. You have destroyed homes carved in stone that have stood safe and cool for decades.
I lifted a hand, and she retreated back a step, as if I were threatening her. I dropped it again quickly. These were very suspicious people. No alliance, I said. We're not expecting any direct cooperation. All I'm saying is that both of us will fight only these intruders, not one another. When they leave or are destroyed, then everything goes back to the way it was. Della nodded and then flashed me a tiny, tight smile. I think it was the first smile I'd ever seen on her face.
I can get the others to agree to that, she said. But don't ask for more.
I wouldn't think of it, I said. I was proud of that lie. From her expression, I could tell she believed me. It had been smoothly told, and it was for a good cause. That's the best kind of lie a man can tell. Naturally, I wanted more than a truce. But outright peace wasn't going to come easily, especially not after the Primus had bombed out their homes so relentlessly. We had to earn their trust, and this sounded like a good first step.
Watch the skies for the little things that waver in the air, she said, pointing over the ship toward the cliffs. They have aircraft that will drop canisters. The vapors will render the strongest man unconscious.
I turned toward the ship and stared above it where she'd pointed. I thought I saw something up there. Something like a black leaf with a triangular shape to it. I turned back to ask Della if that was what she'd meant. But she was gone. Explaining the deal I'd arranged to my superiors wasn't an easy task. I was only a specialist, a non-com, and a junior one at that. I was told by Leeson in no uncertain terms that I lacked the authority to do what I'd done. He kicked the connection up to Graves, who rumbled something about me having larger genitals than was normal on a human being. I took this as a compliment, but I wasn't sure he'd meant it that way. He kicked me up to the Primus, connected the two of us, and then quickly exited the channel. When I made my report to the Primus, I was met with outright fury rather than mere disapproval.
"You did what?" she demanded. "Who the hell do you think you are?"
"I'm Specialist James McGill, sir," I said evenly, "and I was following orders."
"Whose orders?"
she said quickly, guardedly. I'd been referring to her orders. She'd instructed me to talk to the colonists and make contact. Sure, she hadn't indicated I should arrange any deals, but I'd seized the opportunity that had presented itself. By her tone, I knew right off she wasn't thinking about her orders. She was wondering who else might have given me leave to operate independently. In the past, I'd been given private orders by the Tribune himself. I'd executed those orders, and the Primus had gotten herself into a lot of trouble by interfering in the matter. I decided to bluff my way through. "I think it would be best, sir, if you passed me up to the Tribune himself," I said, knowing that she'd been reprimanded for not doing so in the past.
"You're a red-assed bastard, McGill,"
she commented, then connected me to the Tribune. "McGill," Drusa said. "Why do I know that name so well, Specialist?"
"I'm not sure, sir, but I've made contact with the enemy."
"Which enemy?"
The ones hiding in the cliffs, sir. The wild colonists.
Good, he said, sounding amused. Now, what was the nature of your contact? Is the Legion being sued for paternity, or...
I knew he was joking, of course, but I was alarmed. Did I have that kind of reputation all the way up to the top? The thought was disturbing. How could a man hope to succeed with the ladies if he was infamous?
Nothing like that, sir, I said. I talked to the leader who called herself a scout. I understand she's a military officer of sorts. Anyway, we agreed to halt all fighting until this new threat is dealt with.
We're not connecting clearly, McGill. You and I.
Drusus said dangerously.
Are you saying you negotiated a ceasefire with an enemy combatant without orders?
No, sir, I shouted. I'd never do that. Primus Turov ordered me to make contact with them yesterday. I was to see if I could get them to talk peace. Well, I managed it.
He said. A day late and a dollar short, as they used to say. But I think we'll honor your unsanctioned ceasefire. You do realize that you were operating without authority on this.
I swallowed and hesitated. I could bullshit most people, ask anyone, especially my parents, but I had known right from the start that Drusus wasn't just anyone. He always seemed to know what I was thinking almost before I did. When caught red-handed, there are only two moves a man can make. You can deny everything in the face of the facts, or confess utterly, and try to look dumb or at least harmless. Drusus wasn't going to fall for a lie. So I chose the latter strategy this time.
Yes, sir, I said, and left it at that.
Good. I want no misunderstandings on that point. If there is future diplomacy to be done, let me do it. But I'm willing to take the opportunity to improve our tactical situation. We're in a bad spot, McGill. I'd like to fly the other lifters to your valley to repel the enemy, but I don't dare now. The lifters are unarmed, and they are our only ships. They'll be destroyed if I try to come to your position. Your cohort is cut off. We all are.
I didn't like to hear that. I'd had in the back of my mind the assurance that the rest of Legion Varus could always back us up if things went badly here.
We'll stop shooting at the colonists, as long as they stop shooting at us, Drusus went on. At least until these new arrivals demonstrate their intentions.
I explained to him then what Della had told me about the invaders and what I'd seen with my own eyes.
Very strange, he said, and alarming. If true, this isn't a galactic visitation. It's either an offshoot of the same colonists or a separatist group among separatists. Or these giants are in league with the cephalopods.
After talking to Della, I think it's the cephalopods, sir, I said.
That's worrisome news. If they're behind this, we can claim innocence when order is restored to this system, but it might not matter. The Galactics might well blame us for something our own species has done, even if it was done by specially bred human slave troops. I'm liking this entire situation less and less.
What are your orders, sir? I asked.
Obey your officers, man your cannon, and above all, McGill, try not to get us into a fresh war of some kind.
I'll do my best, Tribune.
A quiet, tense standoff began after that, which lasted for several hours. The invaders from above didn't seem to be in any kind of hurry. They'd first unloaded about 100 littermates, then began unloading a great pile of other stuff. Natasha and I watched them from the ramp of the lifter, excited about whatever it was they were doing.
Just imagine the tech they must have, she said. An entirely alien species, unspoiled by galactic influence. It's moments like this that make first contact situations unpredictable and memorable. I hope I'm allowed to collect some scraps of it. We'll have to steal a few pieces before the Galactics blast it all to fragments. Are you with me, James?
Yeah, sure, I said, bored and tired. I was, in fact, trying to take a nap. Natasha was cute and all, but she liked to talk too much and was overly interested in what I considered to be a pile of alien junk. My only interest in it was whether it could kill me or not.
We'll have to do it after these aliens march into the catacombs and try to fish out the colonists, she said.
I looked at her and frowned. Do what?
Go up there and steal a few pieces of their equipment. I'm flying buzzers toward it right now. They don't even seem to care. I'm getting such good vids. Should I share them with your helmet?
If it makes you happy, I said, shutting my eyes. I could see things flash and flicker on the other side of my eyelids. Damn, I was tired. I passed out for a time after that. When I woke up, Natasha was standing next to me. Her foot withdrew, and I realized she'd kicked me awake. That wasn't as bad as it sounded. Wearing heavy steel armor protected us from things like a friendly kick. The thumping had probably awakened me rather than any sensation, as I could barely feel her boot slamming against my hip.
What's up? I asked, coming awake with a groan. I can't believe you can sleep at a time like this. They've reached the catacombs. Our units are falling back from them, letting them march forward. Check it out.
I stood up wearily and dialed up my scope. Things had indeed shifted on the battlefield, if that's what it really was. The ship had unloaded a great deal of equipment. Most of it I couldn't even recognize. There were big crates, small ones, a few in between. They had devices that were conical, spheroid, or even flat black planes that were left lying on the ground. Around me there was more activity as well. Most of my unit had been revived and was now guarding the lifter in an expanding circle. And Grant had set up the revival machine in a secluded spot away from the lifter. In retrospect, it seemed like that precaution was unnecessary now that the colonists weren't attacking. But on the other hand, keeping the revival unit safe was even more important now that our cohort had been cut off from the rest of the Legion.
Look, Natasha said, pointing across the lake. They've reached the fallen rocks. Our people aren't fighting yet. I wonder what they're waiting for.
I frowned in concern. I looked back and forth from the ship to our line of retreating troops. I could tell what was happening.
The Primus is pulling back, I said. She's going to let the aliens march right into the caves the colonists set up. Yeah, so?
I made an exasperated sound.
She's screwing them, I complained. They made a deal with us, and she's double-crossing them. No, she's not. Natasha said in concern. We agreed to stop shooting at them. That's all. If the invaders want to attack them, that's their problem.
Technically, she was right, but I wasn't happy. I'd hoped this arrangement would lead to open fighting with the invaders on one side and our troops standing with the colonists on the other.
First off, I said, the Primus bombs holes in the colonists' cliffs, exposing them to fire. Then she backs up so the enemy can roll right in. She screwed them. They'll die like rats in there.
Natasha looked at me.
Isn't that a good thing?
No, I said.
Why not?
Because the colonists are our people. We shouldn't be killing one another. We should team up and chase these freaks off the planet.
Natasha stared at me critically for a while. You know what I think? She said. I think you're in lust with that half-naked wild girl you've been talking to. I think she's warped your thinking.
I felt a pang. Was it guilt? Outrage? A little of both, I guessed. I went with the outrage as it was a better cover.
Jealousy? I demanded. Now? There are hundreds, maybe thousands of lives at stake here, Natasha. These people are just defending their home, where they've lived all their lives. What if these 3-meter-tall pricks landed in your hometown tomorrow? Wouldn't you want a little help?
She lowered her eyes.
Sorry, she said. Too bad we can't do anything about it.
I didn't answer. I was scanning the scene. The enemy marching in their perfect squares of 9 were climbing up the fallen boulders now, where I knew there were man-traps and ambushes every meter. Now I knew why the colonists had built such an elaborate defense. Then I panned upward, higher and higher, searching for the wobbling little craft that Della had pointed out to me earlier. I finally found it in a new location. It was hovering over the lifter.
Well, I'll be a son of a bitch, I said, looking almost straight up.
What?
Natasha asked, craning a neck and staggering to look above us. There they are, watching us. They're probably wondering what the hell this lifter is doing here and whether or not it's a threat to them. I can see three figures riding up there. What a strange little ship. Seems unstable in the air. It flutters, falling and rising again.
Maybe it was built with underwater travel in mind, Natasha said. After all, they come from a planet covered in oceans.
You know, I think you're right, I said, sighting on the craft carefully.
Natasha, would you like to get a good look at that aircraft?
Oh, yes, she said, sighing. I've never seen true alien tech. I mean, the galactic stuff we can buy seems so well known and generic.
I reached up and cranked the aperture on my weapon to its narrowest setting. The lenses inside shifted with a tiny whirring sound.
Could you turn on that little scrambling unit you used earlier? I asked her.
What for?
Just to make me happy.
Frowning, she activated the jammer. I knew it didn't have much range, so I stepped a pace closer to her. It was supposed to scramble the vid output from our suit cameras, as well as making us untraceable on the net.
What are you doing, James? She asked.
Such innocence. She was the kind of girl I'd always dreamed of back in school. Smart, but a little bit on the sweet side.
I'm going to give you a closer look at some alien tech, I told her.
I fired my weapon without further delay. The beam punched a hole into the bottom of the odd, wobbling aircraft above our heads. Chapter 20. My beam lanced up from the ground to stab right through the aircraft overhead. I could tell right away that the crewmen aboard her were surprised. Two of them fell off, spinning and twisting all the way down until they splashed into the lake. Twin white fountains of water shot up, such was the impact of their fall. One of the figures vanished in a churning spot of bubbles that quickly subsided. The other, however, seemed to be alive. I was impressed by the hardiness of the enemy. If they could live through a fall like that, it had to be a 500-meter drop.
James, what did you do?
Natasha asked. Her voice sounded like she was out of breath.
What did I do? I fired on an enemy combatant that was threatening our lifter. You didn't have orders to do that.
Sure I did, I said. Leeson told me to guard this ship. I've been standing on guard duty out here for hours. I recognized the threat, and I eliminated it.
Natasha looked up. It's not falling. It's leveled off.
I sighted on the ship again. It was harder this time, as the ship wasn't holding still. It was flying in a circular pattern directly above the lifter. Before I could get another clean shot, a smoking object fell from the aircraft. I frowned at it. The object looked like a glass sphere full of a pitch-black substance. A spiraling tendril of gray smoke trailed behind it as it fell.
Incoming! I shouted over the general unit channel.
McGill! Leeson's voice answered.
What's going on out there?
Close visors, I shouted. I think it's gas, sir.
I fired my weapon, but missed. The glass sphere fell nearby and popped. Roiling vapors exploded in every direction, obscuring my vision. My visor was down, as was Natasha's. Not all our troops were so fortunate. Caught by surprise, a few of them slumped, crawled, then stopped moving entirely. The fluttering aircraft moved away then, scuttling back toward the enemy aircraft. I fired twice more and got lucky on the last shot. I missed the aircraft, but I hit the last of the three crewmen. He pitched off the platform. Unguided, the craft slid sideways and slammed into a cliff face. A gush of orange fire brought a smile to my face. A heavy gauntlet slammed down onto my shoulder. I half-turned and was hauled around to look into Harris's bulging eyes.
What did you do, specialist? He roared.
I brought down an attacking aircraft, sir. It was an amazing shot, if I do say so myself.
Harris looked out toward the cliffs, where a spot still burned brightly. Then he eyed the vapors that were hugging the ground stubbornly, refusing to disperse.
"What about the enemy crew? Any survivors?"
I pointed out to the water. We all looked, and my mouth twisted into a grimace. The pilot who had fallen into the water wasn't having a good time of it. The rockfish had gathered around, sensing an injured, helpless victim. I could barely see the man anymore. He looked more like a hump of wriggling flesh. The rockfish, with their wart-encrusted bodies glinting wetly, were feasting.
"How can he still be alive?" Harris asked.
I lifted my weapon again. "Permission to put him out of his misery, vet?" I asked.
"Since when do you ever ask permission to fire your weapon, McGill?"
I just looked at him.
"All right," he said, sighing. "Do it."
Fire lanced out of my tube and the water steamed. The splashing stopped until fresh, living rockfish came up to finish the task their dead comrades had begun.
"Guys, look," Natasha said. She had a scope out and was examining the far side of the lake.
We both joined her.
The situation on the rock pile had changed. The troops that had been laboriously climbing the stones and occasionally falling into man traps had halted and reversed themselves. They were now marching toward the verdant line of flowery growths along the west side of the region. There was a moment of calm. Then Legion Varus did what they had to do. They fired upon the advancing enemy. I watched with interest as the armored square of troops rocked backward, taking the shocks in stride. The laser rifles the legionnaires were equipped with didn't seem to be having much effect. Each hit staggered a trooper, but a moment later he was back in perfect stride with his brothers. "The Primus shouldn't play around with these boys," I said. "They look pretty serious."
"Why don't you call her and tell her how to handle it, McGill?"
Harris suggested.
"I bet she'd like that."
"She's got to use her mortars, or at least her plasma cannons. I'm just saying."
As if I was a fortune teller, my fellow weaponeers stepped up the assault. Lasers weren't penetrating, so heavy beams lanced out, taking down troopers with each shot. Sometimes two fell to a single beam. They rarely got back up. At that point, the battlefield shifted again. I got the feeling both sides had been hesitant, feeling out each other's capabilities to inflict harm. Now the littermates were convinced. Just as Della had intimated to me, the armored enemy didn't take kindly to watching their brothers die. They changed demeanor suddenly and completely, as if a switch had been thrown. They'd been marching in precise order, lockstep, almost methodical in their movements. Now their calm melted and turned into wild rage. Their slow, measured steps became sweeping bounds. Their limbs, once quiet at their sides, came up and formed gauntleted claws.
"Holy shit,"
Harris whispered at my side. The troopers charged. It was a berserker thing, and an astounding rush of metal-encased flesh. The beams coming out of the flowery embankment ahead of them increased to an almost frantic level of fire. Energy beams were released steadily, but struck the ground as often as armor, forming glassy patches on the sandy soil and smoky holes in armor. At the last moment, a line three ranks deep of our own heavy troopers rushed forward. They carried the banner of the Wolf's Head emblem, and Legion Varus's best rushed to meet the maddened enemy. The two lines crashed together. We were too distant to see the details, but I could tell our men were using force blades for the most part. They were sawing and hacking limbs from their larger opponents. The enemy was not helpless, though. They had large pistols, which they used to great effect at close range. And hand to hand, they wielded heavy sabers to hack and hew. I wished I could have been there with my comrades. Outnumbered 4-1, the massive berserkers could not win. But they did reap a terrible toll. Before the struggle was over, dozens of our silver-armored legionnaires lay in the mud.
"Not one of them broke. Did you see that?"
Harris demanded.
"Not one of those big bastards would turn tail and run. They all fought to the death. They fought until they were chopped apart."
I didn't say anything. Neither did Natasha.
Harris hit me then, slamming his fist into the back of my helmet. The blow didn't really hurt, but it did cause my head to ring. "Did you want me to add something to that, vet?" I asked. Harris glowered at me.
"If I find out that you started this fight, so help me, McGill, I'll kill you myself."
"You'd be well within your rights, vet," I said calmly.
"Don't think I won't do it, McGill. I've done it before."
"You have indeed, vet. I haven't forgotten." For several long seconds, we had ourselves an old-fashioned stare-down.
"I've been tired of your bullshit for nearly 2 years now," he told me. "I can't wait until you muster out."
"Haven't you heard? I'm re-upping, planning to become a lifer." Cursing and muttering, Harris disappeared into the ship, leaving Natasha and me at the bottom of the ramp. Natasha looked after him in concern. She put a hand on the back of my helmet.
"He dented your helmet," she said.
"That's Legion property, too." She gave a small, nervous laugh. Then she spoke with me in a hushed, worried voice.
"James, what if he finds out what you did?"
I shrugged. "I don't think he will. I think he'll have plenty of better things to worry about from now on. Look." She followed my arm and gasped. Fresh troops were marching down from the huge ship. These new enemies looked different. They weren't all standing in perfect nines, either.
"Are those squids?"
Natasha asked. "Looks that way." A group of cephalopods had emerged for the first time. They were the same size as the human troopers they'd bred for war. I realized that now. I wondered if they'd tried to make them in their own image, growing them and altering their genes so they were the same size and weight. There was something creepy about that. This species was a cold one, and I found I liked them less with every passing hour.
"They might have made a mistake," I said hopefully.
Legion Varus hadn't been slow to react to this new threat. They fired a barrage of heavy beams toward the cephalopods. But the beams didn't reach the enemy. Instead, the energy splashed and flickered as each beam was intercepted by a shimmering field of force.
"They put a shield up,"
Natasha breathed.
"A shield big enough and strong enough to cover their entire ship."
I nodded thoughtfully. The squids had just moved up a few notches in technical prowess in my estimation.
"How are we ever going to get through to their ship if they have shields with that kind of range?"
Natasha asked. I didn't reply, because I didn't have an answer. I watched as the squids calmly rummaged in the equipment they'd piled outside their ship. No wonder they hadn't worried about protecting it from fire. They were in no danger from our weaponry, now that they'd shielded the region. While we looked on, the fresh troops kept flowing down the ramps. Before they were done, there were twice as many as there had been. They all stood in calm, perfectly formed squares of nine. Their black armor gleamed like star-studded space. As we watched, a protuberance began to slowly lift from the crown of the ship. It was oblong, sleek, and quite large. By my estimation, it was at least 30 meters in length.
"What the hell is that thing?"
Natasha asked.
"Looks like a big weapon," I said.
"Or it could be a sensor of some kind." As we watched in growing concern, the object began to swivel, coming around slowly.
"It's got to be some kind of cannon," I shouted. I reported in, but it was hardly necessary.
Half the people in the valley had seen it. The threat was unmistakable. Across the lake, the legionnaires, who'd been busy removing valuable equipment from their dead comrades, stood up and bolted into the forest of flowers. I heard the tactical chatter and tuned into my overall unit chat. They'd been ordered to withdraw and scatter. For several seconds, as the giant turret traveled, I felt certain it was going to fire on the troops who were fleeing certain death. But it didn't. The big weapon kept turning, slowly coming around until...
"Run!" I shouted.
Natasha was right behind me. We didn't really have anywhere safe to go, so we ran to the lake shore.
I leapt out into the water just before the air grew blindingly white and a tremendous beam of power flashed out. The beam